Today's show is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Cufflinks.com. Go to Cufflinks.com/DVR so they know we sent you. All month long until the release of Marvel Avengers Endgame, use code ENDGAME30 to get 30% off your order of officially licensed Marvel products. And this season, we will be giving away a Hand of the King or Hand of the Queen pin every week from Cufflinks.com because they have a marvelous selection of Game of Thrones items. Not to mention the other fantastic products they have. They'll set you up. You're having a wedding, an event, whatever, go to cufflinks.com/DVR. They got you covered. Now on to the show. Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. We have a very special guest and a very special program today. But before I introduce this person, I do just want to take an opportunity to thank everyone for listening and all the kind words and downloads and everything from the series rewatch. And just the last episode I did with Heath, I woke up this morning with some great messages from Bill and John, and I want to give them a shout out and thank them very much. And it really means a lot to me. This community is awesome. And that's kind of what this podcast today is about. But I did also want to tell you again to go to Guess the Throne. Guess the Throne is a place where you can create a group and guess who lives or dies this season. You get a point, and at the end of it, you see who wins. And it's going to be a really fun thing. And every Monday, the guys from Guess the Throne are going to come on our live call-in, talk with DJ Tim Hines, go over some of the data, talk about how they decided. And we might do a little deciding, too, because actually, I'm neutral in this, and DJ as well. We're not taking part in this. So if there is a question about is someone really dead? Is someone really alive? How do we call it? We're going to join in as neutral arbiters. So I'm not taking part in it. I want you all to know that. But go to Guess the Throne. It's a great thing. I also want to thank Pandora. Subscribe to us on Pandora. They've been featuring us on their homepage on the app. It really means a lot. I've been in contact with them. They're great people. Thank you, Pandora. Thank you, Stitcher, for featuring us. Thank you, iTunes, for featuring us. Thank you for subscribing and listening, everyone. That's all I got. Remember, we're going to be doing 4 shows a week. Now let's get to the good stuff. You heard me. Now it's time. Ladies and gentlemen, we have waited 5 years for this moment. And I know he's getting nervous on the other line. He's ready to talk. I want to hear that giggle. Do we hear the giggle? There it is. Ladies and gentlemen, he's back. I'm so happy. I don't want to get too emotional here, but yes, that is Ken. Ken, how you doing, buddy?
I am doing great. This is like the Starks reuniting, right?
Seriously, man, when we were talking on email and then I was rewatching, I got choked up. I was thinking, like, it just goes to show you how many friends and how this show and how just sharing something together can really just bring your heart out, man. And really, I'm so happy to have you back and be talking to you. I can't wait to hear all the stuff you have to say. We've all missed you. The number of times we've been on a podcast saying, oh, Ken, can you hear us, Ken? You know, man, it's been a while. So we know you've been gone for a while. We were just talking. It's been since season 4 that you podcasted on Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things. So yes. Maybe, you know, if you want to say hi to everyone or whatever, I'll just give you a moment.
Well, first of all, I want to say that anyone who ever supported the podcast Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things and supported me personally as a podcaster, I say thank you. I think fondly of those days when I used to put those shows together, and definitely big shout out still to Matt. Yes. To Matt Murdock. He was my mentor, my podcasting mentor, really. And he's really the person who inspired me personally and through Podcast Winterfell, which now you've done such a brilliant job sort of captaining, shepherding the ship to this day. But I have to thank Ed, all the emails I got during the time that I was podcasting, all of the support I got. It meant the world to me, just as you were just saying, kind of the communal aspect when you love something like a TV show or a movie, to be able to use this technology, this wonderful technology that we now have, where we can become interconnected in a way that even 15, 20 years, 10 years ago, we couldn't, and kind of have shared experiences, right? And it makes it more profound and emotional to be able to bounce ideas off people and bounce emotions off people and just sort of riff about the stuff that you love. And so that's what I miss about podcasting. I was never like a technical wizard. And so kind of putting the shows together after a while started to wear me down just from like a technical point of view.
Oh, I know it, buddy. Just sitting there, like the little wait, stop and wait, like you edit, you got to wait for this. You do it. You know what I mean? And like, yeah.
Yeah. And I kind of just at some point thought, you know, I need to take a break for personal reasons. But also I thought, I think I just want to go back to just loving the show and experiencing the show as an audience member. Because what I found myself doing, and I don't know if you go through this now, when I was watching the episode, I was actually thinking about my podcast I was watching the episode, and I was taking notes thinking, oh, I got to make sure to write to talk about this. And that's what you have to do, I think, to be a really good podcaster and to be a responsible podcaster. But at some point, I also just wanted to like enjoy the show, which is, you know, like listening to you talk about your rewatches, especially these last ones that you did in prep for season 8, has been great, because I think you yourself have on a number of occasions talked about how it's just great to go back and revisit that from, and how much more of an emotional resonance some scenes had for you that maybe they didn't the first time around. So, I kind of just wanted to get back to that and just take a break. But I do think fondly about the podcast and about all the people that reached out to me while I was doing it. And it's really great to be talking to you again.
Ah, that's awesome, pal. And I totally feel you, man. You know, that's a struggle. And it's interesting that as we progress in time, you know, and we first started doing this with Matt, and of course, all praise goes to the creator, Podcast Winterfell. Matt forever has a room. It's like in the White House, how they have like the Lincoln room.
Right.
In Winterfell, he has like the Murdoch wing. And he can come whenever he wants. It is a struggle to watch the show and not, when a big moment happens, not think about, oh, I can't wait to talk about that, or what just happened. And in the formulation of figuring it out, you're taking into account the reaction, how you're going to talk about it on a podcast, and it can kind of take you out of it. You know what I mean? It breaks the suspension of disbelief, right? You're kind of like your own life is thrown into it. It's kind of like when you're in a movie and so in a big moment, someone takes out their cell phone and looks at it or something, you know? So I totally understand that, man. And the technical aspects, if I wasn't so into that from editing, and it kind of like satisfies a certain like OCD factor that I possess, that I like putting things together like that constantly, it really does get a lot. But the important thing is that you're here now. We're talking, we're having fun. And we were talking before, I can't believe there's so much that's happened in the time, and we've got this great season coming up.
Yeah.
You had some things that you wanted to talk about, but I think we got to start at the beginning, because you always were, and while I was rewatching, I was thinking about you, because we had made contact before I did the rewatch. I think, maybe, I don't even remember, because to me, you're always in my mind, Ken. And we've got to start with your girl. You were always a big fan, and and for me too, helped me in rewatching, understanding the character on the show and in the books of Sansa, because that's your girl. So
talk a little bit
about what we've seen, because we didn't even, the Ramsay stuff, all this stuff, we haven't heard from Ken.
Well, of course, the Ramsey stuff was hard to watch.
Yeah.
It would have been hard to watch whether whoever he was doing that stuff to. The fact that it was Sansa was made it particularly emotional, especially for me, because I attached myself to that character nearly from like the pilot, when like everyone else was like rolling their eyes at Sansa because she was a silly little girl. I there was just something almost right from the beginning where I thought, I know what George is doing with this character. I know how he's going to deconstruct this. I know how he's going to deconstruct like the little princess, and how he's going to make a girly girl a hero. And somehow I thought that that's what might happen. And I hoped that that's what would happen. And then somehow that is kind of what happened. And I've been both emotionally invested and kind of intellectually invested in a lot of the characters, but probably none more than Sansa, because that's not a character who rises to the top in a lot of fantasy stories and in a lot of genre stories. So I've always been interested in how a girl who's not the spunky tomboy, but who is like concerned with makeup and dresses and court courtesy and someone who's sort of weak, like physically weak, someone who's not going to really be able to defend herself with a sword. How does someone like that survive in a really cutthroat world like George has created in Game of Thrones? So the fact that she uses her mind and her heart to me makes her a revolutionary character. The other thing that's true about Sansa, no debate about it, and it's true of a lot of the characters, is that she's a slow learner. You could say the same thing about Jon and Dany, and even Arya. A lot of our main characters are on really, really long learning curves. And George seems to delight in making the learning curve as even longer than you think it's going to be. A character will take one step forward and then take three steps back. And then it'll go on and on and on. And Sansa's no different than anyone else in that sense. Did it take her a long time to get to where she is now? Absolutely. should it have taken her a shorter amount of time to get to where she is? Maybe. But I think that it was always emotionally honest to me that it would take someone, especially a 14-year-old girl or a 13-year-old girl, a longer time to get to where she is right now. And so I've always been interested in Martin's use of these sorts of characters. And I'm delighted that there's a character on Game of Thrones who is probably never going to wield a sword, who's never going to wield a dagger, who doesn't know magic, and who writes letters and talks to people.
that's such a great point, Ken. And you know what? That's why I think if you go back and you can even listen to us talk about Sansa back in the day, I had a hard time connecting with her because of the reason I am the opposite of all these things that you spoke of. And I really was connecting just right off the bat with characters that I kind of maybe either even look like, right? Or have had experiences like I say it a lot on Twitter and stuff. I mean, I think I would win. I think if we had a Game of Thrones podcasters lookalike, I would run it away with it by looking like Tormund without any doubt. I just need to do my hair a little bit, grow the beard a little longer, and it would be like, okay, dude, you win. So that's what I look like. And my experience through my life has been being a physically intimidating, large guy with a deep voice that everyone listened to, you know, and challenged physically. And I have always been in my own life attracted more to a woman that's more like kind of like a tomboy. You know what I'm saying? So you hit upon it that the it's kind of like that manic pixie dream girl that became popular. Yeah. I too was falling for those same tropes of looking at Sansa and saying, I'm just not interested in this princess character. I was never interested in a girl like that. I don't like, I kind of reject that societally because I'm also like a very sensitive, I feel kind of feminine dude, even though I am physically big. And I was and even when we look at our society and the kind of questions we're asking ourselves generally as a society at this point, with this rewatch, and I'm so glad to be talking about it, I was able to let go of a lot of that, you know, for the first time for this show, not that in other times I haven't been able to, but for specifically, there was something about Sansa, and it's maybe it's just the beginning stuff that I got so mad at her when over the thing with Arya and the butcher's boy that got me really like, that was one of the first things in the show where I was like, I got mad at Sansa. And now that I have a 6-year-old son and the age thing always kind of got me in the show too, because I'm always thinking, oh, they're really older, you know, but I really saw exactly how you described it just then. This young girl who just had a dream to be a princess. This was what she was taught. This is what was expected of her, what her mother told her, what she grew in. Both her and Arya grew up in opposition to each other. They formed their personalities in a lot of ways by looking at the other and doing the opposite.
Yeah.
And for attention, for finding their rightful place in the Stark family or in their culture as a whole. And I really came to see it. Now, I wasn't super – I wish that season 7 – had given Sansa a straighter line, more perhaps if she had confided more in Brienne, we would have been able to see what was happening with her and Arya and Littlefinger, or if she confided in somebody at Winterfell, we could have seen a little bit more of her point. And in the books, I'm sure you'll get that, right? But I love the way you say that she has no magic, no sword. She has herself. And in the end, that's us.
Right.
You know, I don't have a sword. I don't have magic. So Sansa really is a great entry point for almost, it's almost kind of like, I kind of saw it for me in this rewatch almost as a vulnerability test that I kind of have to open myself to her character. And she allows entry into understanding this really gray world.
Right. Yeah. And also the notion that, and she's not alone in this, you could say the same thing about Arya, or especially the Stark children in general, Bran, Jon, Arya, and Sansa, they've all had teachers, right? And they've all been open to being exposed to different types of people and points of view, and then taking on certain things from each mentor that is going to help them in the future. And in Sansa's case, she had multiple mentors, including Cersei Lannister.
Yep.
Her mother, the memory of her mother, Cersei Lannister, Peter Baelish, Marjorie Tyrell, Lady Olenna. The list sort of goes on about people that Sansa observed over the years and was able to come into close enough contact where she was able to glean things. And even if it was through osmosis, where she didn't know even in the moment that she was actually learning something from them, it became apparent in that last speech that she gave to Peter Baelish right before he was executed in the final episode of season 7 that she was listening. Whether she consciously knew it or not at the time, in that moment, she realized all the lessons that she had learned, and how she was going to incorporate that into every decision she made moving forward. So, and really you could say that about any of the main characters, but particularly the Stark children. John had lots of mentors. Arya had lots of mentors. Bran had a number of people who looked after him and who he, looked up to. So, I think in some ways this is about, to me, one of the things that this story is about is about being open to learning things, and being like opening yourself up to the world, right?
Yeah.
And
definitely.
And opening yourself up in a way where you're able to take everything in, the negative and the positive, and then letting that shape you.
Yeah.
And being vulnerable in a way, in a specific way, where you're able to be shaped, and then you're ultimately able to shape yourself. So
definitely, dude. And also in that process, exactly as you said, you take a step forward, and then sometimes you take two steps back.
Yeah.
And when in season seven, like when I said this in the rewatch, when Sansa arrives at Winterfell, finally with Theon, right?
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I get the rewatch now. It's so much in my mind. And that is like the first time really in her life. And what follows when she kind of like speaks over John at the big King of the North meeting, right?
Yeah.
And is challenging him in front of everyone and is becoming a little bit, is really overstepping boundaries. That was not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But that's the first time she had an opportunity ever to do it in her entire life, you know? And I really, it hit me that like when she arrived there and I'm like, wow, like she was trapped by the princess factor. Then yeah. She was trapped by really being the princess, you know, and everything she went through, she could never speak. Like the first time in the whole show that Sansa ever says something where she feels like, where I felt like it was really her, was with Lady Olenna when she says, Joffrey is a monster.
Yeah.
That's the first time in the whole show that she is able to actually speak her mind. And then she's not able to do it again until she gets to Winterfell, because I don't count the time with Littlefinger, just Littlefinger, because she never trusted him. She always right. knew who he was, but she wasn't. What was she able to do? So initially, I admit, when I saw that season seven, I was like, oh, come on, what is this? Are they trying to make sense of this? And I had to take a step back and I had to say, wait a second. This is the exact type of thing that I talk about of great characters are inconsistent. A great character isn't a person who wakes up one day as Superman. That's right. not interesting. What's interesting and what's real is that people are like the ocean. They ebb and they flow. And yeah. sometimes they make a right decision and sometimes they make a really wrong one. And we've seen that with, look at all the decisions John made, you know? I mean, hell, you want to talk about a bad decision in season seven, how about running after Rickon and then losing the Battle of the Bastards and Sansa, you know, basically saving you, not basically, but really saving your ass. Now, she didn't tell him about Littlefinger or that, but that's because she was navigating this world for the first time.
Yeah, and she didn't, even though there was a familial connection, she hadn't seen John in a long time. She didn't, and she had just come from a place where she'd been terrorized by Ramsay for a long period of time. And I think she was feeling him out. She didn't know how much she could actually trust him, because loving someone and trusting someone are two completely different things.
Definitely.
And sometimes the greatest freedom in the world is the freedom to make mistakes and the freedom to throw pasta up on the wall and see what sticks.
Yep.
And I think she was trying out her sea legs. So is she going to make mistakes just like any other human being who's exerting their freedom? Absolutely. But the fact that she's in a position to call her own shots, even if they're mistakes, is a huge achievement for a character like her.
Definitely. So. Yeah, most definitely, man. And I'm really interested. Where do you think she's headed in season 8? I talked yesterday with Heath, and you were telling me that you listened to it this morning.
I did.
And I would, you know, I'm thinking along the line that Sansa will end up basically as kind of, I don't know, the queen in the North, or, you know, I think eventually Jon will abdicate because of Dany. But I'm not sure. You have a good handle on how things work in Westerosi politics and such. What do you think?
Well, you and I have already chatted a little in prep for this podcast about, like, how does Westeros look after a presumed victory over the White Walkers? What does breaking the wheel look like, if that's in fact what Daenerys does? Do we go to a representational democracy? Do we go back to someone sitting on the Iron Throne? So I think that here's my guess and here's my prediction. I'll be bold like Heath Snowlow. I'll say that it's going to be a mixture of the two, and that someone will serve as prime minister to a representational council. And I believe that that person who's going to serve as prime minister is Tyrion Lannister, and that Sansa Stark will be his wife and his partner in being a prime minister to the country. That she will be the first lady of Westeros. I believe that that relationship is going to become salvaged in some way, because technically they're still married, right? They never got a divorce.
That's true.
So, and they went through the ceremony, and I don't know if it's a love connection. Maybe it's a deep friendship and sincere partnership, versus a love match.
Yeah.
But I think Tyrion and Sansa are both people who maybe realize that waiting for a love match maybe isn't the best thing in the world sometimes. So that's what I think. I think she's going to be first lady of Westeros alongside with Tyrion.
So why don't you think she would be, I got to ask you, Prime Minister and Tyrion? I mean, obviously he has the more experience for the job. I mean, he's been doing this for years. You know, he already served his hand, and now with Dany and all that. But do you not see her ascension maybe quicker through season 8, that she gains experience through the North? Or what do you think?
I think that they counterbalance each other.
Okay.
I think Tyrion is more of an intellectual and she's more of an empath. I think that she's more touchy-feely and he's more, let's go read something in a book. So even though he has great instincts, I think that Sansa is much more in touch with, let's just say, the feminine side of politics. So because of that, I think that they would make a good partnership.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like the partnership idea. And I think that a partnership would also, and especially a partnership like that of a man and a woman and of two people who are part of the Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things, they represent this new world, right?
Right.
They're a perfect representation of the coming together, and as a Lannister and a Stark, so many different sides to it. I would be very happy with that. I think that that sounds cool. I wonder, do you think though, because as we talk about this so often people talk about what's going to happen after, and I had mentioned, and you had mentioned it too. Actually, I think I may have first picked up on the idea from you back in the day that they that there could actually be like a new government here. Do you think that they'll have time to do that in the show? Do you think that they'll set us on a course of what the future will be with this story? I certainly hope so. I certainly hope it doesn't end with a hero shot after a battle and we fade to black. I hope that we get to understand how this story could continue without us. Do you think they'll do that?
I do. I think that everything I know about Dan and Dave's writing tells me that the big battle is going to be either the penultimate episode or even like episode 4. And because I think Dan and Dave are going to bake in at least one episode, if not two, to tell the story of the aftermath and to tell the story of what happens to the world now. And I think that I absolutely believe that they're going to do that. If not one episode, I'm actually leaning towards two episodes. I think the big battle, like the Battle of Winterfell between the living and the dead, I'm really looking at that happening in episode 4. And I think 5 and 6 are going to be tying up loose ends. And what does this world look like now? What happens to the wheel? What happens to all of these personal relationships? What happens to the common folk? What happens to the government? What happens to the Seven Kingdoms? Do they all rule themselves? Are they a confederation? Is it back to being an empire? I think all of that stuff will be sorted out in its own specific venue outside of a battle. So I'd be very surprised if Dan and Dave, given all of the writing that they've shown us up until now, end on a hero shot. Like, that just wouldn't seem like a Dan and Dave thing to do. In fact, they sort of championed the whole notion of like the big thing happens in episode 9, remember, like Baelor and Blackwater. And then you take the last episode to sort of tie up the loose ends and look forward to the next season.
That's true. You know what? You make a good point, and that's become a staple of like premier TV. And there are other shows that did that, but Game of Thrones, you're absolutely right. They've set the standard of the penultimate episode, or even sometimes when you think about things happening in, like you're saying, where they have done it, where in episode like 8, the thing happens, and then you have 9, 10, and you still have something happen in 9 or 10, but that huge big battle thing was 8, you know, and you have the couple. I really hope you're right. Because I think there's, as people speak and they talk about their book theories and say there's evidence in the book, right? I'm going to say there's evidence in the show. And that's one of the things that I looked for in the rewatch. And there is plenty of talk about governmental systems, whether especially when it comes to your man Tyrion, who at one point actually proposes in the show representatives and uses that word, if I'm correct. I think it's season 6. He says something like that to Danny, or is it 7? I'm not sure. But no, I think it's 6. He mentions that, that the people have a say. And I really hope that happens, Ken. And I think that would really round this show out and give us a satisfying ending, rather than just who wins a big battle. Cause you're right. That's not the way the show's been. And I guess I get nervous cause it's the last season. That's about the thing I think I'm most nervous about. Like, there's not a lot of things that I like have to, like Heath said, and I said, yes, like, I don't really, there's not something like, oh, if that doesn't happen, I'm going to be mad. You know, like, nobody has to die. I don't need to learn anything. I'm totally cool. But the one thing I really do hope is what we're talking about now, that they give us not just one scene, but actually a little something more about that this world continues. And if it's that much, you know, an episode or two, that would be cool if they actually do dispense with the White Walkers, and then they actually do have to turn their eye to Westerosi politics or Cersei or this army who's still fighting over here. That, yeah, I think would be really cool.
Well, the other thing that leads me to believe all of this is I firmly believe, and this is just rooted in the TV show, you can kind of put the books aside, is that just from the TV show, this story has been so obviously about cripples, bastards, and broken things, about the people on the margins and the disenfranchised and people looking for power, both personal and logistical, who don't normally have it in this world. Women, bastards, dwarves. To me, that's what this story has ultimately really been about, is these people on the margins moving towards the center, a lot of them of a younger generation, sort of taking, finding their own way, going on their own journeys, learning lessons, and then ultimately taking over for the old guard, as you and Heath were talking about yesterday, how like the older generation was going down one by one, yeah, and these new generation of people are coming in, and almost every single member of this new generation, whether you look at Yara Greyjoy or Sansa Stark or Arya or Daenerys or Tyrion, even Cersei, all of these people should be marginalized because of their sex, because of their race, because of their height. All of these people should be marginalized, and they're not. They're not only are they not marginalized, but they've been the driving force of the story. And so I think that's what this has been about. Not that the White Walker thing has been a MacGuffin in the Hitchcockian sense, so therefore irrelevant. It's been extremely relevant. But I think ultimately what this story has been about is, what does someone who's been on the margins, what do they do with power? What do they do with both personal power and logistical power? And so I think that's probably what we're going to see in either the final episode or the final two episodes. How does all of that get wrapped around the powerful or the powerlessness of the small folk, who in a way have been the metaphor for these characters that we've gotten to know? Like, we haven't gotten to know the small folk, but in a way we have.
Yeah.
Because Tyrion, Sansa, Brienne, Yara Greyjoy, they've all stood in for those people who don't have a voice for themselves. So,
now, hey, I was thinking of something as you were saying that, Ken. Because we talk about the White Walkers, and first of all, I want to say I love everything you just said before I totally change to something different. But because it gave me such a cool idea. But you were talking about that, and you were talking about the marginalized and the cripples and the bastards and the broken things. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second, though. We saw this guy, and he looked to be just like a regular soldier. And those little tree people, those children, they stuck him up against that weirwood, and they put the obsidian right into him. And he did not look like he was having a good time.
Yeah.
And in a sense, are not the White Walkers themselves broken things? Aren't they, does that not, like you were saying, you were kind of putting the White Walkers almost in something different, but yeah, I see them like that. And when I see, that's why this show is so awesome to me and meaningful, is that when you see that Night King raise his arm and the dead come up, it's not only that every person you kill becomes a part of his army, or, oh my God, what's coming for us, or all our nightmares have come true. It's a man who was tied to a tree, yeah, and made into something that he did not want to be, in effect also taking power back for himself.
And you just completely blew my mind, by the way, which is like, this is a prime example why podcasting and technology is great in this age, because then you and I can have this conversation over a podcast and you can blow my mind when you say something like that. And then I can think, you're absolutely right. Like, they are they fall under the umbrella, right, of cripples, yeah. bastards, and broken things because of what the children did to that dude. And so, but you could say the same thing about Cersei, right? In a way, she's like a White Walker.
Yeah.
In the way, like, what do you do with your marginalization? Do you let it give you the license and excuse to be a horrible person and to dominate and to be negative and to be psychopathic like Ramsay Bolton and Cersei and the White Walkers? Or do you let it enrich you, like, and let you move you into the positive light, like, say, someone like Sansa or Brienne or Sam? Yeah. So I think that's probably, I think you and I could probably write this script today, and, because that's what it seems like the story is about. Like, not only what are you going to do to move yourself away from being marginalized, but how are you going to do it in a way where you get to keep your humanity? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so.
And that's that makes me think, is it possible, you know, there is in the books this truce, right?
Yeah.
That was supposedly, and all the, we could get into a whole weird, I mean, I've been having crazy ideas since I finished my rewatch. I've let my mind go about who really built the wall and who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, and everything could be different because that's the kind of story that George created.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we all think there's going to be, and we, you know, there's going to be a big battle and it's the White Walk and they have to be destroyed. Is it possible that somehow they make an agreement, or is it possible that Bran is able to communicate with the Night King or empathize with him, or somehow could they, and this is going to sound insane, could we see like a team up with the White Walkers somehow? I mean, initially I think just team up wise, or maybe they have like John and the White Walkers have to go against Cersei, or something, you know? But, all right. We're going to take a little break from Ken, man. It's great to talk to Ken. What a wonderful guy. And he always has such a holistic and beautiful way of looking at everything. I just want to tell you to go to cufflinks.com/DVR, use code ENDGAME30 to get 30% off your officially licensed Marvel product. Also, check out their Game of Thrones stuff. We're talking all about it. They have so many awesome Game of Thrones products. Just perusing their selection gets me excited. And we will be giving away a Hand of the King or Hand of the Queen pin every week this whole season on Podcast Winterfell. And we want to thank Cufflinks.com for being the official sponsor of Podcast Winterfell and just giving me the opportunity to put all the time into this podcast that I love to do. And trust me, you're going to get a lot of special episodes this season past what we're regularly going to give you. And that's going to be because of cufflinks.com and the patrons too. Always want to thank the patrons. Now back to the show. So I'm not particularly saying that the White Walkers would, you know, particularly be the good guys, as you just said, but I'm saying more so that we could come more to empathize with them, because one of the things is that scene in particular really set me off, and I still think about it a lot, why that's there. I know it's not in the books.
Yeah.
And I think that that was there to make us have a little bit of a heart for the White Walkers, to understand them, and for them not to just, even if they seem to act as a like singular force of evil, just wanting to make everything frozen and dead, there is a reason. And that reason is also connected to all of our other characters, that their agency was taken away from them purposefully.
Yes. God, you're continuing to blow my mind, because I never really thought about this specific thing. And now that you've opened up my eyes and my ears to this notion, I mean, it falls right into line with the whole theme of the story, right? About what do you do? How do you react when your agency and personal power have been taken away from you? And I agree with you, like in the same way that you can understand where Cersei's coming from, but still not like her as a fictional human being. Like my heart goes out, in a weird way, my heart goes out to a Cersei because Robert never loved her, never gave her a chance. Her father treated her like property. Mm-hmm. She had to grow up with, you know, a father like Tywin Lannister. She had these weird, complicated feelings for her twin brother, and she didn't have a mother to talk to about it. She didn't have anyone who was like a reasonable human being to grow up with because her mother died when she was really young. And I'm not saying any of this to like be like, yay, Cersei, or like, I like you. No, I don't like her. She's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like you were just saying about the White Walkers, all of that stuff about Cersei that I just said makes me understand where she's coming from.
Yeah.
And it doesn't maybe necessarily make her sympathetic, but it does make her understandable.
That's and a great point, dude. And that's the thing, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, I think human beings in general have an issue with empathy and with allowing themselves the duality of saying you are responsible for what you did, but I understand why you did it, even though I don't agree and I wouldn't have done that.
Yes.
You know, exploring that empathy isn't saying, oh, they're okay. Oh, everybody's good, really. No, empathy is allowing for a multitude of emotion and allowing yourself to investigate another person's motives freely and without attachment to they're bad, they're good. And I see that in the White Walkers, like I see that in Cersei, in the same way that I see that with Tyrion, in the same way that I see it with Arya. I mean, Arya is a cold-blooded killer.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But lover. Oh, look how cute Maisie Williams is. Oh, yeah. Like, oh, look, it's little Arya. Oh, look at her stab that guy in the heart. You know, like, but Cersei and that, you don't get that. And yet they have done a pretty masterful job, as has Lena Headey, of allowing us to have that empathy for Cersei. And, you know, I sometimes jokingly refer to her as my queen. And I mean, it's just like you said, she's been through so much. She's dead inside. Then she's literally alive inside. She now is pregnant. Where do you see Cersei going? And what do you think about, what was your reaction, Ken, to the kind of last second switcheroo discussion with Tyrion, John bend the knee for me that happened at the Dragon Pit, and where do you, and then Jaime leaving too. I want to hear all about what you think about what Cersei was thinking there, what happened, and where do you think she's going?
Well, I listened to what you and Heath talked about yesterday, and I was like, I was yelling at the computer monitor because I wanted to jump into your pre-recorded podcast and join your conversation. I think I'm going to say something really bold. I think it's bold. I think Cersei is psychologically pregnant, not literally pregnant. Oh. I think she 150% believes that she's pregnant, which is why she was subconsciously touching her belly when she was talking to Tyrion. Like, I think she thinks she's pregnant. But I think Cersei's the type of person who doesn't realize that she lost all three of her children in like a year or two. And she had just lost Tommen. And I think she doesn't understand that she's like experiencing PTSD. And that maybe one of the results of that is that she's convinced herself that she's pregnant.
Wow, that's something really. Now, can I ask, has George done anything like that before? Is there anything that makes you think that like in the books, or how did you come about this? 'Cause I can see it too. And I didn't believe it. I said it on the show. I didn't believe that she was pregnant at first, because I just thought, similar to what you're saying, she's in like almost like a manic state or a disassociative state.
Yeah. Yes.
Where she is so separate. She believes in her mind that she can control what happened to her, right? Because everything is about control to her. But that when she does that thing where she talks, why did you kill my daughter? Why? And then she's, and then she does the whole face change. I was like, wow, not only is that amazing acting, but I've experienced this before, because I have, as I think many people have, been around a person who is in a dissociative state or is kind of separated from reality, and it can be very uncomfortable, but that actually happens in real life. And people in that state go on to convince themselves of things and do things that are weird, like the whole bend the knee, John, the world is end. Like, we often, we put ourselves in these situations, right, Ken, when we think about what would I do or what should the person do?
Yeah.
Without really being them and thinking, well, Cersei's like out of it. And now she's sitting with all these people and the brother who killed her father. And it's like, it's just like we do to famous people or politicians. We de-emotionalize them and we act as if that the instance they are in encompasses all of their existence. When that incident could, like, you know, they having an emotional reaction, as we saw, as was illustrated when the Hound goes and confronts his brother in front of everybody. You know, like, the emotional things have a huge bearing on what's going on. So I'm almost talking myself into thinking that you're right, Ken. Like, I'm thinking, it makes sense. I don't know how they show that, though.
Well, I think that sort of dissociative break that you and I are talking about explains, like, everything that you sort of preface the Cersei stuff with. Yeah. Like, because there's an inner truth that wants to come out, which is maybe like an inner knowledge and of truth and realism, which is maybe why she spared both Tyrion and Jaime. Because she knew deep, deep down inside, some truth that not even her trauma could overtake. But then she's really good at, like, putting on that, like, I'm dead inside mask at this point.
Yeah.
So, and I don't even think it's a mask at this point. I think it's, like, her skin. Like, I think it's just, it's overtaken her. It's, in a weird way, it's not totally unlike Reek Theon. Because he also experienced a high level of trauma and became dissociative because of it for a while, and kind of still is. Like, he's still sort of dealing with the aftermath of, like, a year of being tortured by Ramsay Bolton. So, I mean, it's not the exact same thing, obviously, as what Theon went through, but in a weird way, it is still about your mind breaking because of extreme trauma. Yeah.
And that is such a thing, Ken. Sorry to interrupt there. I just want to, because what you said was brilliant, because that is so many of our characters. You have to, the trauma that was, I thought, upon rewatch too, so greatly illustrated by the War of the Five Kings that this whole land has been through, right? So many of our characters, like you're talking about, the mask that they wore became their face. And what other great, I mean, that just makes me think of Arya. And that makes me think of how Bran isn't even really a Stark anymore, right?
Yeah.
He's not even Bran anymore.
Correct.
So the thing you went back to, you said like about a half hour ago about how we make a choice, how something is going to affect us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see these choices, and sometimes people make the choice and they regress. And then they take a step forward again, like we've seen with Theon, right? Like, oh, Theon gets his redemption. And then what happens to Yara? He just jumps off the ship.
Exactly. Like there's not a single character on the show that hasn't been through some sort of trauma. Like, but then George and Dan and Dave have done such a great job of painting the spectrum, right? Because on one end of the spectrum, there's the Davoses, the Sams, and the Briannes, who've all been through a lot of trauma, but they're like good people who make good choices and they persevere. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have like the White Walkers and Cersei and Ramsay Bolton and Theon, who seem to be giving in to their trauma and letting the trauma darken their soul. And then the rest of the characters are like somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. So, but it's all about choices. It's all about, like, that's what I mean when I say personal power versus logistical power. Because to me, personal power sometimes means like you feel empowered to make a positive choice, even though crappy things have happened to you over and over again. So sometimes personal power is about how you choose to see the world.
Yeah, that's great, dude.
And someone like Brienne and Sam and Gilly, like, think about Gilly. Like, here's, like, she's such a, like, such a side character. But she was having sex with her father, and he got her pregnant.
Yeah.
And all of her sisters were, like, living with her. And she had to watch this old gross man, like, have sex with them periodically.
And
like,
they were killing, and they were giving all of their boys to the White Walkers.
Right. But think about how sweet she is. And think about, like, how guileless she is. Think about that scene, like, with Sam's family, where she's, like, standing up for Sam and, like, but still, like, being nice to his mother and his sister and, like, behaving like a reasonable human being, even though she's been through all this trauma. And the reason why she's doing that is because she's made a choice. She's making a choice about how she wants to see the world and how she wants to live in the world. Yeah. And so I think that's the other thing that this story is about, is like the power, the choices that you make, the power you think you have, the power you do have. Like someone like Cersei, maybe she just wants to play the victim in her own mind. You know what I mean? Like, and she doesn't want to take any personal responsibility.
Yep.
And
all she knows is how to act by reversing that, right? She thinks that the way to make it equal is to inflict that which has been inflicted on her on other people.
Yes.
And which is, you know, she wants she doesn't want to break the wheel. She is the wheel.
Right. You know? She wants to run over more people exactly. with the wheel.
She's become the wheel, right?
Right.
She physically is doing that. So what do you think is going to happen with Cersei? Because I made a bold prediction. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of think that there's I don't know how bold it is, because I think that there's kind of, you know, we've seen the wildfire and once, twice, three times. I think it's kind of, it makes sense that she may try to lure them to King's Landing, or that she may reenact and do what the Mad King was unable to do and basically burn it all, you know?
Yeah.
But in general, I mean, you don't have to say, you know, we have to get too down to that theory, but do you think Cersei will be redeemed? Do you think she will, because there is also another thing of saying, hey, maybe Cersei will actually decide to help, and maybe she'll be like Littlefinger, right? Who ends up saving the day. Where do you see that going? What would satisfy you, or where do you feel it's going?
I feel like she was at the final crossroads when she was in that cell at the Sept and had to do the Walk of Shame, and she made a choice. And the choice was that she could have either let that experience, that horrible experience, by the way, she could have let that horrible experience turn her towards the light, or she could have gone even darker. And I think it's pretty obvious which choice she made when she got to that fork. And so now I think she's at the point of no return. Like, I don't think Cersei's coming back. I think she made her final choice, and she's going to, like, Thelma and Louise it over the cliff in her convertible car. Mm-hmm. So then it just becomes a question of like, who is the instrument of her final destruction, i.e. death? And I think it's got to be one of the boys. Like, I think it's all about those three kids at the end of the day. And I think Cersei meets her final fate either at the hands of Tyrion or at the hands of Jaime. And at this point, I'm leaning towards Jaime because I just don't think Tyrion, as much as he hates her, as much as he has reason for wrapping his hands around her throat, mm-hmm. I just don't think he's not that type of person. That's not who he is.
Yeah, especially after he killed Tywin, which I think is an act that he did was not premeditated, and also Shay too. I think he was in a state there, and you see that he wanted to basically drink himself to death, you know, and they both, Jaime and, like, I feel that both Jaime and Tyrion had those awakenings coming out of the water, and Jaime decided, you know, he saw what was going on with Cersei and Dany and the power, and we see where he's gone. But yeah, I think you're right, man. I don't think there's any coming back for Cersei. And I thought it was strange. The one thing I'll say about the pregnancy, I thought it was strange the way that Jaime left and that wasn't even mentioned.
Though I wonder what he meant, but I'll throw this at you. Did the line, "I don't believe you," have double meaning?
Ah, okay. That's interesting, dude. I like this now, Ken. Ooh, see, we're blowing each other's minds, Ken. We just came on this podcast to blow each other, baby. That's what it's all about. I got to watch that again because I thought it was so weird. Like, it became the crux of the conversation with Tyrion, right? Earlier it was her big deal with Jaime, and it was like, oh my God, all of a sudden, like a light had gone on in Cersei's eyes. And in many ways, if I look at it writing wise and character arc wise in a meta sense, it allowed the Dragon Pit meeting to happen.
Yes.
Right? Because if she wasn't pregnant, I would have gone in there thinking she was going to kill everyone. Why not?
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. So it made me think, no way this is going to really, when it happened, it made it believable. But then when they're arguing at the end and Jaime's like, you know, are you going to have him kill me? And he's like, you've lied to that. We've got to go for the future.
Yeah.
There wasn't, like, she didn't say to him, but what about our child? You're again leaving your child. She could have went for an easy, like, you know, mean thing to say, right? An easy dig. Once again, Jaime, you're failing your children. You let them die on your, you should have been protecting two kings that were your kid and they're dead.
Yeah.
And you did it, you're doing it again. But no, it was like, it was more of a power struggle, and it was almost as if she forgot.
And it's almost like he picked up on the fact that she forgot.
Okay. We could be totally wrong, and the first scene of season 8 could be Cersei having a baby. But I kind of like this right now, and I think it kind of makes sense that it would be a delusion on her part, whether knowingly or not.
Yeah, and I'm convinced it's not knowingly. Like, I think she thinks she's pregnant, and I don't believe she is. It's almost like a hysterical pregnancy.
Mm, interesting.
Let me throw another few things at you.
Okay.
This will be like a little bit rapid fire. Here's one. I don't think we've heard the last of Grayscale. What if the White Walkers are susceptible to Grayscale?
I like that. There has to be a reason it played. So it couldn't just be Jorah's reason for going away, you know?
Right.
And they went to Valeria for a reason.
And maybe Sam read a book about, he read a book about Grayscale to cure Jorah. Maybe there was something else in this book that he read that will occur to him, and maybe they can weaponize it. Maybe.
Maybe my man Qyburn can get involved with that. I have that whole theory about him somehow because he knows about the dead. You know, he's studying it. I like that, Ken.
The other thing is, I don't like knowing Dan and Dave's writing and how economical it can be often. I don't believe that John and Danny have the conversation about her inability to get pregnant in that final episode, unless it means something.
Yeah.
Like I don't believe they write John to say, you know, why don't you think you can get pregnant? And she's like, because the witch who killed my husband told me I couldn't. And then he's like, well, did you ever think that maybe she wasn't a reliable source of information?
Which is so funny. When he said that, I have to just say that was so funny because it's like, that is the type of thing that when you're sitting home watching TV and somebody says something, you're always screaming at the TV and you're like, well, why do you believe them? You know what I mean? And then John said it. And I thought it was kind of, it took me out for a second, that line, because it almost seemed like modern in a sense or something. You know what I mean? That he was kind of like, what, did you read that on Twitter?
Well, also it was funny. And John is rarely funny.
That's true. That's true. And it showed, it was kind of a cool scene too, because that little exchange was good to show their attraction to each other.
Absolutely.
And the way he felt, for some reason, John, the guy who is kind of really always emo, uncomfortable around everybody, was kind of comfortable around Danny and felt that he could speak freely to her. And then freely enough that he would say something like that, which was also a little bit like, we always kind of associate John with the Ned thing of like, you believe people's word. And even if they're whatever, you kind of listen to them. So that was interesting. You're right. I do. Yeah. What would happen with Danny getting pregnant though?
Well, the witch said that because of the thing that happened, the spell she had to perform to sacrifice the child to save, quote unquote, save Drogo, that left her barren for the rest of her life. At least that's what the witch told her back in season one. So, but if anyone's going to have a child in season eight, it's going to be Daenerys. That's my opinion.
And that takes her out of the battle too, though, doesn't it?
It may take her out of the battle. And if she has a baby, then maybe that's the Song of Ice and Fire.
Do you think that? Do you think that maybe that baby will be raised by Tyrion and Sansa?
I don't. Well, here's what I will say. I don't believe that baby is going to be raised by Daenerys. So whether that means she dies in childbirth or she dies for some other reason shortly after giving birth, I don't. You and I were talking a little bit about this. I don't think Daenerys survives this story. So, and I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how she goes out. A hero's death, a villain's death, who knows? But either way, I don't think Daenerys survives this story. Here's one last thing I'll throw at you. Because I keep thinking back to dialogue, particularly from season seven, that Dan and Dave thought was important enough to include. And there was that great scene between Arya and Sansa at the end, after the Littlefinger execution, where they talk about the wolf pack. I think that the Starks all survive. I think every Stark who's alive right now is going to survive the end of the story, because I think that the idea that they're now all together, they were the most vulnerable when they were separated. But the fact that they all survived and now they've come together, I think all of them survived. Now, are all of them happy? Do all of them? I mean, because just because you live doesn't mean you get a happy ending.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that means that they get happy endings. But I do think that none of the Stark children who are currently alive will die. Like, I think they're.
I like that. I like that. I hope that's true, Ken. I really do. And I don't think that the story calls for or necessitates any of their deaths at this point. You know what I mean? Like, you could look back and you could say, oh, in the arc, it looks like, hey, that makes sense. You know, like with Jamie, it makes a lot of sense. I don't particularly want Jamie to die. I don't, but it kind of would make a bit of sense with what he's been through. With the Starks, I like that. The pack survives. I also think in many ways, like I've said, Bran and Arya, are they really Starks? They are like themselves. They like transcend that because they have this duality, and Bran is kind of like the holder of knowledge,
yeah,
you know, now, and this three-eyed raven. But I would agree with you, right? Like, I don't think any of them will be killed.
Correct.
I don't know that they particularly, especially Bran, I kind of feel like he may float away back to north of the wall, like the three-eyed raven, or even in some way transcend into the Weirwood network or become it.
Yeah. You know?
Or becomes something greater that is a force of good that watches over Westeros in some weird way. I don't know if I'm getting into magical stuff, but
yeah, that's a great prediction.
Go ahead.
I just think that the idea that living doesn't necessarily correlate to I can still feel bittersweet about the ending of something, even if someone lives. Right. And then the other thought I had, was I think that if Jaime and Cersei entered the world together, they're probably going to exit the world together.
Mm. So I had not considered that. That's a good, wow. You're right. They did enter the world together. That I often forget that they're twins.
Yes.
You know, I often forget that and the significance of that. Wow, that's really interesting. And my nephews are twins. You know what? I got to say, twins kind of creep me out. I'm sorry, nephews. I said that to my sister. And actually, my sister said to me, it's funny because my sister and I, growing up, we'd kind of be like, twins are kind of creepy because we're like Irish twins. We're so close together. I think it was our own way of being like, wow, we're really close, you know? But then she had twins and they're wonderful, but that is so significant. And I had not thought about that. Well, listen, Ken, I literally could just keep on talking to you and let my son starve in the next room, but he needs to, I don't want him to have the trauma of Cersei and others. So I'm going to get him lunch. I'm so happy. I want to tell everyone that Ken's going to be back and he's going to be doing an initial reaction for us. I'm so excited about that too. So I think we have scheduled episode 2 that you're coming on.
That's
April 21st. And I'm also going to be trying to talk to you as much as I can and get you on more too. So you can guarantee I will be bothering you, but I'll take care of all the technical things. And
I appreciate you. I feel like I started this journey with a handful of you, of which you were a major part of that. And so it feels like a lot of things, but one of the things it feels like is it feels poetically correct to sort of do the last leg of this journey with you as well. And so it's been great. It's been great talking to you and kind of bouncing stuff off you. And my brain is still like leaking out of my ear because of what you said about the White Walkers. So I'm going to have to let that percolate and like sink in, because I'm still sort of in shock about that revelation or that possibility. So I really appreciate you giving me a platform and letting me come on and just kind of speak my mind. So I look forward to further conversations. That would be wonderful.
That's awesome, Ken. Yeah, dude, this has been fantastic, brother. This is what it's all about, man. The community, you know, I often think it used to be, and I wonder if this is really a stat, they used to say like, once men get to be like 25 or 30, they don't make any new friends. You know, you hear things like that. And I think about how wrong that is for me. And it's primarily because of podcasting, because I've met so many people, and I'm going to be 45 soon, past the age of 30. And I was 34 or something when I started this journey. And in the last 10, 11 years, I've made so many friends, people I talk to every day. And I just, it's great to have you back and talking to you, man. And, you know, it's just like on Game of Thrones, you know, you're like Bran. You took some seasons off and now you're back.
That's, you know, right, what I mean? That's right. I'm like Bran, but not in a wheelchair and not dead inside.
There so. You go. Yeah. And that's the way I like you, baby. All right. Thank you so much, Ken. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Once again, go to Guest of Throne. So much fun. Start your death pool. Thank you to Stitcher and Pandora, iTunes, everybody for featuring us. It means a lot. But most of all, thank you, everybody, for listening. We do appreciate it. This is going to be a great season. And I think I was going to, I think I'm dropping this Friday. And I hope everybody has an opportunity. I'm going to do it early so everyone has an opportunity to listen. And this is going to be so much fun, dude. I can't wait, man. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I'm stoked too.
Definitely.
This is going to be a great season. Like I definitely agree with Heath that the number one prediction is that this last season is going to be a great ride.
Definitely. All right, let's leave it there. Peace out, everybody.
Peace out.